Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
From the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network for movie talk, this is Historic Hollywood, spotlighting the most influential and founding members of Hollywood.
Welcome, popcorn talkers, to another edition of Historic Hollywood, a celebration of the cinema of yesteryear and the people who made it. Make sure that you follow the network online there at youtube.com/popcorntalknetwork, all over social media at The Popcorn Talk. I am Lex Michael. I'm all over the social media things at The Lex Michael, and with me is
Byron Thompson.
You're on the Twitter thing too, right?
I'm on the Twitter. I'm everywhere too.
Twitter same thing, yeah. At Byron Lee.
That's right.
I remember that one. So we were off last week, but we are here once again, triumphant, to resume our discussion, our sprawling conversation about film noir. Now, in part one of our conversation, we talked a lot about the history, the origins of the style, the formation of it as a school, a collective way of making films as it emerged in Hollywood. And we got up to, give or take, 1950-ish.
And we spoke specifically about Kane.
Yes.
And Orson Welles and how influential, even though we wouldn't necessarily call Citizen Kane a film noir, how its overreaching influence, clearly, anything we talk about today is going to have that thumbprint on it for sure.
Yes. And so when we talk about stuff that, you know, we're talking about today, we're going to go from about where we left off, about 1950, 1955-ish. We're going to talk a bit about international filmmakers who employed some of these noir stylistics that we talked about in part one. And we're going to talk about noir's lasting influence on films until the present. Because what I discovered, which I thought was fascinating, as I was doing a little bit of research on different movies that are considered to be neo-noir, which is essentially just is noir, but newer,
Well, go ahead and I'm just wanting to stop you right there for a second. Go ahead and define that for the audience, because neo-noir can have not just a mention of new noir. Are you meaning it as a, like, what we would consider modern noir? Is that what you...
Yes.
I just want to make sure I understand, maybe.
Yes, absolutely. But it was fascinating to me because we talked, like I said in part one, about how noir, a lot of people debate whether it is, strictly speaking, a genre or more just a collection of stylistic traits. And it's interesting how when I was looking at lists of film titles, recent movies that are considered to be, to varying extents, neo-noir, it became clear to me that, like, for example, anyone listening, if your film taste is anything like mine and you've liked a movie in the past 20 years or so, there is a decent chance that it takes some of these stylistic elements that originated in the noir films that we talked about in part one. And we're going to talk about some of the ones that we really like that we think are worth highlighting. But I wanted to start today, this part of the conversation, talking about noir internationally in the late 40s, early 50s, because we focused so much on what was happening in Hollywood, and we didn't get an opportunity last time to talk about filmmakers like, I mean, Akira Kurosawa. We talked about before we started the show, we were throwing titles back and forth at each other.
Right. It was, I want to say it was 85, maybe, or 86 when I got turned on to Kurosawa, not having any idea that he had done a noir, clearly. And it was one of those things where, you know, we were talking before the show about the discovery of these things. And I think the one we specified was Stray Dog.
Yes.
Drunken Angel, obviously. He did these films, and because also we were talking, they came so late here in terms of the gap of time, 2-3 years or whatever, that by the time they got here, they were almost, like, you know, considered gold.
Right.
Even though, to us, it was all just part of the noir cycle, so to speak.
Right.
Great, great films, especially Stray Dog.
Yeah, and Stray Dog has a lot of these similar elements that we talked about, and also a lot of elements that would later be, you would find pretty frequently in buddy cop movies as well. So Kurosawa is a perfect example. I brought up on more than one episode Jules Dassin's Rafifi, because it's a movie I absolutely love. And he was an American filmmaker, but because of his various political and legal stresses at the time, hung out in France for a little while and made what I think is a perfect example of the type of noir heist movie that we talked about a little bit on the previous episode as well. Movies like Asphalt Jungle, which we've talked about multiple times, movies like Stanley Kubrick's The Killing, about men going and doing their work happens to be stealing things from places, and how Rafifi, like some films of its kind, has this phenomenal piece in the middle of the movie, which is this silent heist that they pull off. It is an absolutely phenomenal sequence. And then, like in many noir stories, you watch as this team of professionals not only crumbles, but they all get their comeuppance in various ways. So that was an example that stuck out to me. But you and I think really, and we had talked again before we came into the studio today, there's a filmmaker in particular that you and I are a very big fan of, and I think exemplifies noir stylistics on the international stage perhaps better and more consistently than any other, and that's Jean-Pierre Melville.
And because you brought up Jules Dassin's, because you brought that up in the centerpiece with The Silent, which of course is clearly what makes that movie so special, bringing up Melville, which of course I couldn't say enough about Melville, I think that he did something incredibly different than that by trying to make the heist messy.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to say that he borrowed from Jules or anything like that, but it seems like his movies, and I think you would agree with me, they're the last word.
Yep.
on this. It was as if somehow he had this crazy idea that, oh, well, I'm going to do it perfect, if there was such a thing. And I've seen all of his films. I think you have, too. I can't think of a better place to basically talk about the international effects of noir. To me, it's the last word. His stuff is so beyond reproach. Not that I don't love the American noirs that we're going to speak about. It's just that his stuff seems to be almost like he had to like prove himself, even though I don't think that was necessary. But his films are just, you know, we talked about Bob Le Flambeur, which is not part of that cycle with Loose Samurai and the Doosium Shuffle and stuff. But it's like those films, when you watch them, it's almost like you think, even though they may have come after, you almost think the noir stuff that came before somehow borrowed from that, which is clearly impossible.
Right.
But it gives you that feeling. It seems like that was the wholly original thing, even though clearly it's not.
Well, in a way, I agree with you completely. It feels like everything that we had seen in this type of film up to that point was building towards what Melville did.
Oh, absolutely.
And there are so many of his movies, and he has such a fascinating, phenomenal filmography, and you listed a couple of titles a second ago. I wanted to just maybe narrow it down to a couple, because there are a couple of his movies that rank not just among my favorite movies of their kind, but my favorite movies, period.
Let's start with the obvious one.
Which is?
Do I have to say it? I will. Loose Samurai.
One of my favorite movies of all time.
And its influence, not to try to get off track, but since we're talking about the influence, it's our friend, filmmaker Quentin Tarantino, that basically wanted to make everybody in Reservoir Dogs like Jeff. You know, the gloves, the hat, all these ideas that he had for the visual cues, so to speak. And I don't think I had seen the film when I saw Dogs. Once I saw it afterwards, it seems like, you know, the perfect fit.
Yeah.
The influence is just so strong. And I think you would agree, what you were talking about earlier, everything moved towards that. Loose Samurai seems almost like the conclusion, the peak of what noir is. It's just a flawless film.
It's interesting. When I saw it, I didn't see it finally till a couple of years ago. I saw it out here when the comedian Greg Proops was doing one of his Greg Proops film clubs at the Cine Family.
Great place.
And yeah, amazing theater. If you've never been to LA, when you come visit, make sure that's one of your first stops, because it's a phenomenal little movie house. It used to be the Silent Movie Theater. Amazing place. They do so many excellent, cool.
Tom Fairfax, right?
Yes. So many cool, fun screenings, but I saw this film print.
And he hosted.
This film print of Le Samurai, and it was missing a chunk near the end. That was a little off-putting. But watching this movie, not knowing much at all about Melville's work outside of what I was seeing directly in front of me, it's you get this feeling watching it that it is a culmination of things, and at that point it felt like a culmination of things I did not yet understand, and then felt specifically because of the way that movie affected me, an overpowering need to start understanding what went into and informed this fascinating, phenomenal, ice-cold movie that I was watching.
Well, you and I spoke of in the last episode about noir and the stylistics, and especially the influence of Citizen Kane, the visuals. The thing I wanted to say about what you were just talking about, Loose Samurai, is it's a silent film.
Essentially.
And that's very odd and very off-putting for anybody that is like us, like fans of noir, because there's always these hard-boiled conversations, these things that push the story forward with the femme fatale and all these things. Loose Samurai almost has none of those things.
Yeah.
Almost a silent film, but yet it is pure noir.
Absolutely.
It's as if that is the creation of noir that it's all moved towards, like you were saying earlier. And when I saw it, I had the same feeling I was lucky enough not to have anything missing at the end. But when I saw it, I was, it was like seeing Star Wars for the first time.
Yes.
I watched this movie and I thought, I don't even know if I could ever do anything in this business if something like this exists. It was that good where it's like, it stunned me. I'd never seen anything like it.
And it came out.
And it's just a movie. It's not like somebody came up, you know, and it was old. Clearly it's an older movie, but it was crazy wild. It was perfect.
Well, and it came out after, well after what is considered to be quote unquote the classic noir period.
Oh, absolutely.
And yet it's loaded very anachronistically with so many of these aesthetic flourishes. Like you look at, I talked about in part one of our conversation about how when I think noir actors, I picture Humphrey Bogart in the trench coat and the fedora.
Well, I used to.
Yeah.
Until this. You're absolutely right.
But it's like now you look at this movie and you see Alain Delon in a very similar getup. Well after. The
trench coat.
Yeah.
It is. It borrows so much from the American idea, makes it his own.
Yeah. But well after the time that style was in fashion.
So you know what the gloves are, right?
What do you mean? Well, I mean, I know what the gloves are, but...
They're editor's gloves.
Yeah.
Which I thought was the coolest thing, being somebody who learned how to cut on a flatbed. I was like, editor's gloves? And then the more I read about Melville, he said, oh yeah, he said, that was... I want it to be clean.
Yeah.
And I thought that was, even like you mentioned, that's a noir flourish. It's like, clearly unto all the film Till the Samurai. And of course, you were saying that you wanted to maybe highlight two of his films. What would be the other one? Since we've kind of covered The Samurai, obviously.
Well, I would think it would come down to, if it was only going to be one, and this is just based on what affected me the most,
sure.
It would either be Bob or Le Cirque Rouge. Because I remember seeing both of those movies for the first time and having this experience. You know how you see a movie sometimes? For a lot of people, it was Star Wars. For a lot of people, my generation was like the first time you saw Pulp Fiction or Fargo. You see a movie and there's everything that you thought you understood before you saw it.
Right, right.
And then there's everything now that will be you and your life going forward after seeing it. And I had a very similar experience both with Le Cirque Rouge and Bob Le Flambeur. And they're very dissimilar, but they share so many things in common that bleed from the same source.
Well, I think Bob Le Flambeur, not to rule against one or the other, I clearly feel it's such a character study.
Yes.
Been remade, obviously, as The Good Thief with Nick Nolte.
That's right.
Here in America with the great director, Neil Jordan. But I kind of think that maybe the other film should be Le Cirque Rouge, because going back to the Jules Desson cars, it's the heist film, so to speak, which... I think that kind of caters more to what we're talking about in terms of noir.
Yes.
And I think Bob Le Flambeur is clearly a noir, but a very kind of a singular idea. The character study, it's a different type of thing. I think the other film I would go with, Le Cirque Rouge, just from what you were saying.
So let's talk a little bit about Le Cirque Rouge. I really like, too, since we're talking about that immediately after talking about Le Samurai, I love that both movies open with an on-screen quote that he attributes to a literary source. In Le Samurai, it's this quote
Bushido.
That he says is the Book of Bushido.
Right.
Of course, it's not. It's a quote that he completely made up.
But it's attributed to, you know, the warrior, the samurai.
Yes.
Clearly.
And he completely made... Same deal with the quote at the beginning of Le Cirque Rouge. It's just something Melville made up.
Well, think about his name. Let's start right there, since we had talked about Orson Welles last episode. Here's a guy who wasn't sure he was going to be a filmmaker.
Sure.
And he wanted to start and only get attention. So he chose the name Melville, because he felt that was the greatest book ever written, Moby Dick.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take Melville, and I think that in itself is almost hysterical. But when I was introduced to him, and I'm sure you had the same feeling, never crossed my mind. His stature is much bigger than clearly a name. His films, even though we're just talking about these two, it's top mark. I've never seen anything like anything he's done.
Well, and he himself is fascinating. I mean, we could do an entire show just talking about Melville the man.
Even though we're talking about noir, but his stuff had that big of an impact, at least on me.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we're talking about Le Cirque Rouge,
heist film.
It's a heist film, and it's again very similar. You've got these disparate criminals. They're professionals. They have different areas of expertise. They come together, they butt heads, eventually they work together to accomplish a goal, and then like always happens, it all falls apart for them and things go very, very badly.
But I also kind of feel like it too, like Le Samurai is kind of a silent film.
Yes.
In a sense that these characters have very little interaction, and in a lot of ways it's like a Le Samurai times three. It's like the steroids version of Le Samurai with obviously the heist. In some ways Le Samurai is almost a revenge film in comparison to Le Cirque Rouge. I mean, my feeling, just because I love both the movies, I don't know how you feel about that, but I definitely it's much more like the Jules is on the heist. It's got all those, you know, traits, so to speak.
Well, and it's interesting that you compare it to a silent film, and I agree with you completely because, yeah, of how little...
You said they butt heads and things like that, but it's such, the interaction's so brief. It's almost like you kind of almost want to see it again, but it's gone. We're already over here.
And by not having everybody talk and communicate verbally what they're feeling like moment to moment...
Like all the other movies are, right. Which separates it clearly.
There is no... relief in the tension.
And you have to
start,
pay attention.
From the start to the end.
You have to pay attention.
But you want to pay attention.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's so gripping. I think when Greg Proops was introducing Le Samurai, he threw out a bunch of different metaphors. One of them was like it was chewing on ice cubes wrapped in tinfoil.
Perfect.
Yeah. That's how icy cold the movie is. And that's perfect because that's what you see in some of these earlier noirs, a world that is cold, that is sometimes oppressive and punishing. And to see that, also, Le Cirque Rouge is a color movie, as is Le Samurai. And a lot of the colors...
And they feel like black and white movies.
Right.
It's very odd.
What's interesting is they do, but the colors in the movie, to me, pop. And yet, the way the palette is laid out, it does. It feels very much like you're looking at... I don't know how to describe it. It's like you're looking at a black and white movie that's... hopping up and down a little bit. I don't know a better way to put it than that.
Well, the way that I would see it, and I'm agreeing with you 100%, as far as I'm concerned, I feel that both those movies, Le Cirque Rouge and Le Samurai, are the stillest action films you could ever make.
Yes.
But I constantly feel that they're trying to be restrained. So when you said pop, my feeling is, I feel like every cut, every shot, I feel like something's going to explode.
Yes.
Something's going to come out, or something's going to jump out of the frame. Never happens. He's completely in control. They're still movies. They're very, very subtle. But I constantly feel that, and I guess it's the tension, it seems so exhausting to me to watch both of those films. It seems like, and I've seen them both many times, but they're just that type of movie. It's like, it's like just holding it back. It's almost
yes.
like it's just about to pop to the frame. And it does in different ways.
Yes. I agree with you completely. Like, there is a surface level calm, and yet you get to the end of either of these movies and you feel like you've gone through something very strenuous.
Oh, absolutely. They're so draining.
Yeah.
In the best possible way, because like you said, you're just hypnotized. You can't take your eyes off it.
Yeah. So I wanted to, and Melville is great because he obviously made, especially if we're talking about Le Samurai and Le Cirque Rouge, but a lot of his most celebrated works were very, very noir influenced and were, as we said, felt themselves like maybe the pinnacle of what you could do with that type of story. But where those movies came on the timeline is a really excellent bridge, I think, because what I believe we really wanted to focus on too is stuff that everybody listening will know, movies that have come out recently in the last couple of decades that have evolved directly out of this school of filmmaking. And I think Melville's place on the timeline takes us nicely from the era we were talking about in part one into the present era, starting with the 1970s, because it's in the 1970s that I think new Hollywood happened. You had this whole rush of young new blood making very different types of movies. And some of the biggest crime movies, most well-known, well-respected crime movies of all time came out of this era, and they were very, very much influenced by the noir school of filmmaking. Movies like, if you look at French Connection, so many strands of DNA in Friedkin's movie that you find in some of these movies that we've talked about.
And I would be thinking, along those same lines, I would be thinking Taxi Driver.
Of course.
Because the noir, it's like a shadow on these films in some ways, like you
yeah.
said. The DNA is all there.
And, you know, we look at, film noir, as we've discussed, literally means black film. And in many of these stories, the city, this urban environment, this, like the word I've used, is punishing, oppressive urban environment.
Especially in New York City.
Plays such a strong role.
Like a character.
You look at Taxi Driver, it's that. You've got that environment. You've got this dark, isolated character.
Taxi Driver in some ways would be like the modern day Pablo Flambeur, because you have this singular odyssey of this one single person. He might not do as well maybe as Pablo Flambeur,
sure.
but they still have all these things in common. They're by themselves, singular. It's their odyssey, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think that the modern noir, especially since you made the comment about getting into the 70s, I think the last film that Melville did was Un Flick, and I think that was 72.
Yes.
So in a sense, he was like, in a sense, taking his curtain call, just as you said so well, the new Hollywood kind of came in. Coppola with The Godfather, which nobody would even think of that, but if you watch any of The Godfather, the noir influence is rampant throughout the film.
I would agree with you completely. I would say any popular crime epic comes in part from what the noir filmmakers accomplished, whether it is The Godfather, or, and we're, I think we're just going to jump around quite a bit
That's
at this
fine.
Point, whether it's The Godfather, whether it's Michael Mann's Heat, I think borrows a lot from the same ideas of criminals, the men at work, whether it's cops, criminals, men at work doing their jobs, everything falls apart. And if you're going to draw that line to Michael Mann's Heat, go with me on this. You have to draw the line to Nolan's Batman movies.
Memento is where I would start, but it's absolutely because this theory and this idea, as you said, the black film, no film was blacker than Heat.
Sure.
No film was blacker than Memento. And clearly no superhero movie, not to take anything away from noir, is darker than Nolan's trilogy of Batman. It's the Batman I think we all dreamed we wanted to see.
Yes.
And no one's ever going to make that. And then they made it. Which is great for all of us. We all benefit. But by the same token, you talk to people in the mass. That's not necessarily maybe their idea of what Batman is, but that's the Batman we all knew from the comics instead, the darker version.
Which I guess
we thought was coming at first, and it didn't.
Right. But I think that's fascinating how something like The Dark Knight is, you can take all of those.
A perfect noir character.
You can take those stylistic elements and you can trace it all the way back. But yeah, like if you look at Batman Begins, and this is great that I can talk about Batman on this show. If you look at Batman Begins and you look at how earnest and straight and real they tried to play all of that, he is essentially, Bruce Wayne in that movie, is a noir detective type character in a suit of armor.
Absolutely.
And I find that fascinating and wonderful.
Getting back to your version, the hero, the Batman. You mentioned one of my all-time favorite films, Heat. And you're talking about this clear line of noir going through all these films, especially something like Heat. The thing that really impressed me, and I guess it was in Dark Knight, not necessarily Batman Begins, the open that was shot with IMAX, the robbery, which at first some people, especially anybody that's seen Heat, will think, oh, I've kind of been down this road before, and no, you haven't. It's this reinterpretation of that whole concept of the robbery, the heist, or whatever you want to say, with clearly the Joker at the helm, not to give anything away.
Sure.
But I felt when I saw that very much that same rush of feeling, like when we're talking about seeing Little Samurai, or you said seeing Star Wars for the first time, it you're sitting in that seat and it's almost like you're blessed with something great.
Yep.
And that, I mean, that's personally how I felt. And I think that's why you and I both kind of gravitate towards noir, not because we have dark childhoods or we're, you know,
although that certainly helps,
or we're damaged,
right.
Which maybe we are, but those movies, that they speak to me.
Yes.
And that whole idea in his, you know, the Batman trilogy, that's what speaks to me, and I think it speaks to you too.
Absolutely. Now I don't think we can have a conversation about modern noir without talking about Chinatown.
Oh, we can't.
Yeah.
And everybody would be very upset. And the best part about Chinatown, I know you may, I don't know about your research, but Chinatown's almost an accident.
How so?
Because Polanski comes onto the scene with Repulsion.
Yes.
French film, Catherine Deneuve. Everybody sees it, but they talk about it the way that you and I talk about it when somebody says, oh, you got to go to the park to see this thing that they did with the tree.
Right.
Crazy. And everybody goes to see it, even though they don't understand it's in French. But it doesn't really matter because he's become this bankable person because of somebody that you spoke about on this show and I spoke about on this show. Or wait a minute. I did not speak because it was the time I was absent. William Castle.
Yes.
Because William Castle created this movie as a producer that it was his legitimate film, Rosemary's Baby. Which is Polanski's big foray into American film. Because of its success, which had nothing to do with anything except a great film, Rosemary's Baby is amazing.
Yep.
Polanski was going to leave. He was going to go back to France. He was, I think at that point, married to Sharon Tate, and he had a different agenda. It was Paramount and Bob Evans who said, we want to do this film. Nicholson's on. All these elements started to line up. Polanski has often said, I felt like it was just a job. I was happy to do it. But the thing is, to me, the story was so simple. The ideas were so... The time and place, the 30s, I think. He says, I knew nothing about L.A. except
right.
that my friend Jack Nicholson lived there. And I'd love to be there, but I wasn't thinking anything about the history. So it's almost like an accidental masterpiece. And
yeah.
it's pure noir.
Of course.
A noir in the sun is what it is, right? It's because it's bleached. The movie's like burnt orange.
Yeah.
Burnt all to the core, unlike most of the noirs we've talked about. But it's really film noir.
And all the elements are there from classic film noirs.
The femme fatale. Everything's there.
The private investigator who's way over his head.
And lost. Till the end. He's absolutely, even though you see, there's constantly moments in Chinatown with John Huston, Mulvihill, and all these things where you feel like, oh, now I understand what's going on. Like, he tells you, and then you have no idea.
Right.
It constantly keeps bringing you in with more. And I think that's the mark of a noir. It's like, we're like mice just waiting for that cheese. And Chinatown's the perfect modern, as you put it, the neo-noir.
And it, and sure, it paints a picture of a world in which everyone is corrupt. Which
and we live in that world.
We do.
That's our world.
It's a little unsettling.
That's our world.
It is a little unsettling. So obviously Chinatown, I think, is a big touchstone, in the modern era of noir filmmaking. I think another one, and again, we're just going to jump around a whole bunch to stuff that I think is worth noting.
And Chinatown is a must. I agree with you.
Oh, it's in any conversation, not just a noir conversation. I feel like in any conversation about movies that you need to see.
But you and I talked about the rules, or I thought we talked about the supposed rules of noir.
Sure.
And I feel as though Chinatown, and I love it for that, I think it throws all those rules out and still is essential noir, even though it doesn't contain all these supposed elements that define noir. But it is the pure definition of noir, in the same way that Le Samurai is.
Absolutely.
And that's why I think these movies that we're talking about are so important. And I couldn't say it enough, even though wish Carrie was here to second this. You have to see these movies. They're life changers.
Yeah.
And you were going to say, off of Chinatown, you were going to go into the next
essential
film?
I was going to jump way over here and go Blade Runner.
Oh, my God. That is the only disc I did not bring, because I was afraid you or perhaps the audience might be thinking, well, science fiction, fantasy, I'm not sure how that mixes, but to me, Blade Runner is pure noir.
It obviously, yes.
Modern noir.
You've got, and I think my favorite thing about Blade Runner far and away is that I think it's one of the best production design movies that's ever been made.
I'd say it's the best.
I can't think of anything that tops it. Especially, it depends on, because there have been so many different versions of Blade Runner, but depending on which version.
Just five.
Yeah, so only five cuts.
Well, that's enough for me.
Depending on which version you see, the theatrical version was the one that had the voiceover, for example, which was a very common noir staple. You've got your you've got Deckard, your Blade Runner, but he is your private investigator character.
I think it's interesting to note about the narration that one of the reasons why a lot of people said the film was not successful in 82 was because when Ford was asked, Harrison Ford, the star of Blade Runner, was asked to come in and do the narration, Ridley Scott, the director, stood against it and said that he thought that was the biggest mistake. They felt like they had so many screenings.
Sure.
And nobody understood it.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, the Big Sleep story, that they were going to have him come in and do their own version of narration that I think David Webb Peoples wrote or whatever. And Ford was so upset, one of the only times I think he sided with Ridley Scott, that he reads it in this such a almost drunken monotone voice, very unappealing narration, unlike other narration, like we were talking about Memento or something, where it's got this kind of spice and flavor. It's very almost numbing, the narration. But that version exists, and a lot of people love it because that's the first one they saw.
Yeah. And that is one. I prefer the versions of the movie without the narration.
Me too.
But like I mentioned, that narration is, you could lift that type of voiceover straight out of almost any 1940s film noir.
Right. And the things that he says in the narration are so specific to what we're talking about. Their noir flourishes, as you put it.
And not for nothing, that score, the musical score in that movie,
which was unavailable for like almost 20 years. Crazy.
But you could literally, you close your eyes and you listen to that score separate and apart from the movie, you can go just in your mind, you can picture somebody standing on a street corner in the 30s and 40s in the trench coat, in the fog. You know what I mean? It is perfect.
We should say Vangelis did the score.
Yes.
Beautiful music.
Yes, tip of the hat. There are a lot of filmmakers whose entire body of work, or in large part, seems to be influenced by noir filmmakers. I mean, if you look at anything Quentin Tarantino did before Kill Bill, it's very much, I mean, Pulp Fiction is called Pulp Fiction, which is, if nothing else, a direct tip of the hat to the type of literary outlets and sources that these stories were birthed in.
Absolutely. And you said neo-noir, and that's the perfect definition of neo-noir is Pulp Fiction. I think that in a lot of ways, it's just as important of a film as Chinatown in that sense.
Sure.
Even though, like you had made the comment, you know, seeing it for the first time, and, you know, these things, people, Star Wars, Pulp Fiction, whatever it is that they see, but I truly feel that Pulp Fiction's influence is much like Kane. I don't think anybody, you know, and I don't know how much you go to the movies, but we talk sometimes about, like, I think you'd said you'd seen Sicario, which is a great film, also kind of a noir.
In a lot of ways.
But I don't really see any movies anymore that have come out after Pulp Fiction that don't sometimes have that influence on them.
Sure.
And I'm not trying to give Quentin too much credit. It's just that he is a noir guy. That's what is a huge influence on him, like you said, and I totally agree. Even the great Inglourious Basterds, which I love, is full of those noir touches, and he gets to play it up even more because he's in that time.
Yes.
And I think that's misleading to some because it's historical, but it's got all the touches. It's a great film as well.
And I think especially Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, I think have a lot more just because I think he's playing in a version of reality that is, yes, obviously very heightened, but is a little bit closer to the versions of reality depicted in most classic film noirs, whereas obviously Kill Bill forward, he gets closer and closer to making westerns that still, like you say, are full of these little noir flourishes. I think David Lynch is somebody else who half of the stylistic touches that he uses that aren't totally, totally dreamlike are pulled right from noir. And we've talked a little bit about a lot of the movies that we've talked about, a lot of the filmmakers that we've talked about. He pulls very directly.
And we didn't get a chance to speak too much about how influential all these films that we're talking about, Double Indemnity, and we talked about the Twin Peaks thing, but Blue Velvet is, it's almost as if like it's the modern version of a Double Indemnity or a, you know, The Postman Always Rings Twice, clearly The Killing, even though there's no robberies. There's nobody being betrayed. But when you think about it, Frank Booth, and of course, and Laura Dern, and the fact that she has a boyfriend, she's kind of the femme fatale, all these elements that he kind of wraps up in this kind of Americana version, the Rockwell painting, it's noir with, you know, painted black. And I think that that's fantastic because that's what we're really talking about. If it's true what they say in a lot of these books, that noir was just this certain period, we'd be lost. You and I at least would be lost. So we're so lucky that somebody like Lynch is going to kind of carry that flame because that film is pure noir.
Absolutely.
Even though it's a movie like I've never seen, and that's what makes it so special. Blue Velvet obviously is what I was speaking of.
Yes, and obviously, I mean, you look at two, you mentioned very briefly, you look at Twin Peaks, so much of Twin Peaks is very, very intentionally surface level noir.
And that's okay because they call that, there's a cinematic term that is used for that, it's called reflexive. For example, if you, the great, easy example that I can think of is Ferris Bueller. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, at the end of the film, he looks at the audience, he says, "You're still here?
Yeah.
Go home."
Right.
There's this idea that they call reflexive, where basically you can be having a conversation with the, you know, with the screen, so to speak. Not that anybody does, but it's that kind of idea. And I think that Quentin, and especially a lot of the stuff that they do, they have this reflexive idea where basically we're kind of in on the joke.
Sure.
And I think that that's something that he has kind of brought to the forefront, where that wasn't as much, you know, that's more of a comedy thing. And in the dark films, like especially the stuff that he does in Lynch as well, it's very different. But yes. But I like that because I think that brings people into the film more.
I agree with you completely. I think we also need, absolutely must, it is required that we talk briefly about the Coen brothers.
Briefly? Why? Their first film, as far as I'm concerned, because, you know, a lot of people argue about, oh, well, the first real movie that I saw of theirs was, you know, Miller's Crossing or whatever. It's like, well,
Blood Simple.
It doesn't mean anything to me because Blood Simple is their first film, and it's absolutely the noir, the first noir. Jump to No Country for Old Men. It's like the full realization of the ultimate noir.
Yeah.
Much like Chinatown and the sun-drenched, you know, hills of Texas. What else would you like to say about the Coens besides the fact that they're amazing?
Well, what I think is fascinating is that, yes, I think you can look at No Country as the full, like you said, the full realization of all of
those. Because
it's
got everything.
Yeah.
That they couldn't do with Blood Simple. Because Blood Simple is such a small story. It's a great story. I love Blood Simple. I'm sure you do, too.
It's an amazing movie.
And it's so simple because of the stature. It's not a big, big story. No Country for Old Men isn't that big either, but it's big enough to be, in a sense, epic in comparison.
And I think it's phenomenal, too, that in that timeline of their filmography, right about in the middle of it, you have The Big Lebowski.
Right.
Which is, I would say, one of the most beloved comedies, certainly of my generation,
sure,
of all time. And what a lot of people don't realize when they watch it is that it is essentially a Dashiell Hammett detective story where the lead is just a clueless slacker who wants a new rug.
Well, it's the same thing with Burn After Reading.
Yep.
They take these ideas that they love so much and then they kind of like skew them. Obviously, The Big Lebowski is the one that everybody knows.
Right.
But I think that's kind of like the joke. I'm not saying anything good about Hudsucker Proxy or some of the other films that they've done, but they're constantly trying to remake those films. I think with Blood Simple, clearly No Country for Old Men, they're in peak form.
Yeah.
But those other films still exist, and they have those noir elements, even though they're just kind of interlaced.
Right.
Not the primary thing.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to highlight the Coen brothers and how they've taken from those stylistics and applied it to their work. There are a couple of movies specifically that I wanted to hit on, and we got to be conscious of time.
Sure.
But a couple of movies that I wanted to hit on because they are personal favorites of mine, and they are so, so steeped in noir influence. One is a movie from 2005. Maybe you've seen it. Maybe you haven't. Maybe you're a fan. Maybe you're not. Movie very beloved to me, Shane Black's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Probably one of my favorites of all time.
It is a tremendous... So can we talk briefly, again, time conscious, but can we talk a little bit about this movie? Because it is so... The movie is designed like one of these old pulp stories. And there is a fictional story, a fictional book series in it starring a character called Johnny Gossamer.
Right.
Which is somewhere between James Bond and the pulp detectives of these old crime stories.
It should be noted, and I'm not spoiling anything, but this Dashiell Hammett thing, the book series, which of course in the film Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which we both clearly love, it's a pulp is what she's reading and she believes it. He makes a big comment about how, without giving anything away to the audience, about what ends up happening to that character.
Yes.
It doesn't break her heart because she doesn't believe it. It's like the movie in itself, the movie in itself is very reflexive upon itself. There's like almost in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, because you clearly brought it up for a reason, it's almost like there's four or five movies in this movie.
Yes.
And none of them ever really end, but they connect.
And
yep. that's what makes that such a special movie. The femme fatale's there.
Michelle Monaghan.
The supposed hero is there.
And it's Robert Downey Jr.
At his best.
And this was the movie that showed people after his rehab, after his arrest, that he could do this still. And he's phenomenal. He is a crook turned would-be private investigator.
Also kind of an actor.
Yeah, a little
sort
bit.
Of. Who's, I mean, that's part of the story, obviously.
Who is taken under the wing of Val Kilmer, best he's ever been, in my opinion, as this private investigator, this Hollywood private investigator character. And it's all there, and it's all present. And I love... See, here's another direct line that you can draw to something very big, mainstream, and popular that's fairly recent. So you look at Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and you look at how it was, like I said, the movie that showed people, okay, Robert Downey Jr. can do this, maybe we can put a little bit of stock in him. Even then, Jon Favreau had to personally insure him to get him cast as Tony Stark in the first Iron Man.
Right.
But Kiss Kiss Bang Bang was a big part of how he got that gig in the first place. Now, cut to a handful of years later, they hire Shane Black to make Iron Man 3. And so many of the stylistic touches from Kiss Kiss Bang Bang are all over Iron Man 3. And I find that fascinating because you can take so much of that movie and you can draw those lines all the way back to everything we've been talking about.
Absolutely. For sure. There's a thing that I was going to say about Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, because you brought up Val Kilmer. That character is basically Sam Spade.
Yeah.
Gay.
Yeah.
And very verbal.
Yes.
Because it seems like he always has, like, in a sense, the last word. And the great thing to me about Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is, much like some of the other films that we've talked about out of the studio, is it's a dark film.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very dark.
But this is a very funny.
But yet hilarious. Yeah. In the same way that Pulp Fiction is hilarious.
Yes.
But it definitely a noir. And the reason why you brought it up, I'm sure, is because of, obviously, what a great film it is. But you said you had to mention a couple, so that's one.
That's one. The other one, and there are, look, I mean, there are about five other movies that I can mention that I absolutely love. Shane Black got on the scene, was put on the map in the first place because he's the guy that wrote Lethal Weapon.
Right.
And we could talk about Lethal Weapon as applies to everything else we've been talking about because all of that stuff is there in that movie. But if I was only going to talk about one, and we are pretty low on time, so I may only be able to talk about
that's
one.
Fine. We've talked about some great stuff.
2006, little movie called Brick. Written and directed by Rian Johnson. And
who will end up doing the second Star Wars film,
yes,
Episode 8.
Yes, he is now attached to make Star Wars Episode 8. In between,
he's doing it in Ireland right now.
Yeah, so. They're out, yes, which is just the most exciting thing to me. But in between the two, he also made The Brothers Bloom, Looper. So for my money, he's 3 for 3. But Brick, his first
movie. He's 1 for 3,
movie.
I think.
What?
I'm pretty sure he's 1 for 3.
Disagree.
I can agree to disagree, Ebert. But I'm going to go 1 for 3. I think it's Brick.
Oh, if it's going to be one, it is going to be Brick.
And Brick has all these ideas we're talking about.
It is.
Not somebody who's a film student of noir, somebody who is basically embodying noir. And when you see that movie, it's exactly what I was speaking about with Loose Samurai. It's as if it was made by elements that have nothing to do with the film director. It is what we think of noir in today.
Yes.
And I just was amazed.
It is it's a Dashiell Hammett story set in a modern high school.
Right. And it's crazy because that seems like, oh, well, that's going to be kind of like a play. It's going to be silly. Not silly at all.
It's tremendous.
And the cast is off the hook.
It's Joseph Gordon-Levitt in between I'm Little Kid Joseph Gordon-Levitt and I'm Big Hollywood Superstar Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and he does some absolutely phenomenal work as the lead of this movie.
Everybody in it, just it's an amazing movie. I almost brought that as well. It's strange, but we laid up all these movies because we're talking about noir from 55 on. I know we're getting low on time and everything, but it should be mentioned that even though all these films that we're talking about are great, I do want to mention that we kind of skipped over a lot of the stuff that came in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, we could do about 3 to 4 different episodes and still not hit everything.
Right, but what you were talking about, these films that you wanted to mention, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, yes. Brick, Blade Runner, these are three, to me, seminal. Is there another? Or I know you said you could do a whole show.
Oh, there are so many others. What do you got? Like, throw some stuff at me.
Well, to me, personally, I tend to like the sun-drenched, the burnt noir, like we were talking about with Chinatown, and Brick's the same way because a lot of it takes place in sunlight. But to me, the film that always kind of connected with me was The Killers.
Yeah.
And I brought the disc, but there's two versions of The Killers. There's the Hemingway original adaptation, which I think has Burt Lancaster in it, and I want to say Ava Gardner. It's in that set, but the version that really got me was the Lee Marvin. Clue Gulager version with Ronald Reagan as the villain, the last film he would ever make, and the only film Ronald Reagan's a villain. The Killers is a short story about hitman, but basically those are the hitman that opened Pulp Fiction, in a sense. It's the same idea. It's the whole concept of these two hitmen are going to go do a job. You and me, Lex, we're going to go kill this person and get our money, but something's wrong because nobody fights it.
Right.
That's the whole concept of the Hemingway story. It's a very short story. As a matter of fact, the story is not very interesting at all. All the films, which there's three versions, a French one, the American one with Lancaster, and the later remake with Clue Gulager and Lee Marvin, to me, that's essential noir. The same way that Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, I recommend everybody see any version of The Killers because
yes.
This is a Hemingway story that seems to say very little. The movie seems to compound that idea in a noir way, which is what we're kind of talking about. It's more than style. Noir's like a way of life.
Absolutely.
Especially after seeing and mentioning that some of the films you mentioned, like Blade Runner, obviously, and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, because that's what those movies are.
Well, and there's one more very recent example that I want to hit just because it just occurred to me before we have to wrap.
Sure.
And it's an example, very recent, and it's just because everybody's been talking about it. Marvel and Netflix's Jessica Jones. It, first of all, phenomenal series. But that's a noir show. It's a noir show where the heroine has, you know, super strength. But she is the quintessential noir private investigator.
I feel kind of at a loss just because I haven't had a chance to see it. But
you might dig it.
But you're telling me that this is a noir series, so to speak.
Yeah, it is a lot of things. But you watch that first episode and you tell me you don't see noir all over
Netflix.
It. Netflix. Whole season's available. It's so good. I mean, look, anyone who's listened to this show for more than about 15 seconds will know I'm a gigantic nerd. I'm predisposed to like this stuff. But it is a phenomenal show, and it is noir all over. So, we're going to have to wrap really quickly. Byron, sure. Is there anything else really quick you want to throw in?
L.A. Confidential.
Of course, L.A. Confidential is so good.
Because we're talking about the great noir films. L.A. Confidential, Lady from Shanghai from Orson Welles.
Touch of Evil.
Touch of Evil. I feel that, like you said, and I'm not trying to say that we should do another show, but we could easily do three or four more shows just about noir because there's so many different aspects of it. I just say it's all good.
And you know, maybe we will talk more about this in the future. In the meantime, though, anybody listening...
We are going to do
yes.
an episode. I'm not trying to jump the gun, but we are going to do an episode on Orson Welles specifically.
Yeah.
And when we do that, we'll get a chance to pick up where we leave off here and talk about all those.
Yes, absolutely. So we will talk about more of this in the future. In the meantime, guys, if you want to find us and talk to us about noir movies that you like, because we like a bunch of them.
Love to hear from you.
Yeah, Byron, where can people find you one more time on the internet?
At Byron Lee.
At Byron Lee.
Twitter.
On Twitter. And I am all over the places, the things, the talky stuff at The Lex Michael. That is going to do it for this installment of Historic Hollywood. We are going to be on a hiatus till after the holidays. So please, everybody, have a Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Joyous
Happy
Kwanzaa. Whatever you celebrate, we hope you have a great time. We will see you next time on Historic Hollywood.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com.
I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.